Thank you very much, David. I'd like to take the advantage of the chair and ask the first question. Hans, thank you so much. There's a lot of food for thought here within the data that you showed us, and the real opportunity for people to take a look at their assumptions in the context of that data. Some of the most interesting data I thought had to do with some of the attitudes towards Russia and Russians, and also looking at the perception that Georgians now have about the amount of discussion on the part of the government concerning Russia, Russians, their responsibility for ongoing events within Georgia. Is this an indication of that the Georgian people are looking for their leaders to be more willing to take on responsibility and give credible explanations for the processes going on within the country? Or might this also be in some way that emphasis on the Russian aspect, is that a part, might also be considered part of the partisan bickering between the government and the protesters, trying to use an issue like external influence as an aspect of domestic debate?
Thanks. Yeah, I think it's a very good question. I mean, in some ways, it gets us back to the very basics again of what really a government should deliver, ideally should deliver for a broader electorate or for a society. And I think, I mean, one of the key things that most people expect governments to deliver is just a safe space in which a safe political space. I mean, you know, providing safety, security is, of course, a core function of really any government. And that there's an exhaustion in Georgia with a continuing sense of crisis, and where the idea, I mean, if I had to interpret that, that's my personal interpretation, I would read it as saying something like, those machinations may be real or they may not be real, but ultimately this is your business. You have to take care of that. And please provide us a space in which you do not charge particular issues with doom and an impending sense of crisis. And I think that's something we see then in other components as well, so that it's something about having a moving beyond black box explanations, oh, there's Russia, oh, there's this, oh, there's that, into what's actually going on. Let's talk about the details. Let's actually try and fix some of those issues. And please make sure you actually listen to us. That's really what I take out of that. So I think, I mean, it speaks both to the particular, it speaks to Russia itself, but it also speaks to more broadly the types of discourses that are going on in the society.
David, did you have any thoughts on that based on some of the things that you're hearing from Georgia? Oh. Julian, can you take the mute off?
Oh, sorry. Yeah. actually, I have a question to Hans, if I may. Whether he and his colleagues made this distinction between Russia and Russians while asking people questions on that issue, because it's very important. As you saw here on this slide with marriages, Russians are one of the most favorable or the most favorable partners in after Georgians, I think. And if you see at the slide where the people speak about countries which are unfriendly towards Georgia, Russia is again on the first place. So here you see the difference in the attitude of the people in Georgia toward Russia as a state, as a country, and Russians as people, as a nation. So this is a very interesting topic, I think. And could you please elaborate a bit on that?
Yeah, no, I think you already put it there pretty succinctly, that we do see people being able to discriminate relatively well about with regards to the politics and the state authorities and the actual neighboring country, and that it's the personal relationships don't seem to be as charged at all as the type of broader political context is.
Um,
We have questions here in Prague, if there's space.
Okay, absolutely. Let me take a follow-up question here in Washington, please.
I'm just curious. My name is Michael Volgar, and I am a graduate student. I work in D.C. Can you talk a little bit about my follow-up question is, if you see that same sort of interaction in Azerbaijan with Armenians, when you see the Armenian government and the Armenian people, do you see those numbers?
Okay, a specific question on Armenia.
One quick thing. We could not hear that question over here, so maybe you can repeat it.
I'll just repeat it on my end. Whether we saw a similar distinction in Azerbaijan whether people distinguished between the Armenian people and the Armenian government. No, we do not see that. And I think, in Azerbaijan, the environment is much more charged and much less willingness to cooperate right now for all the reasons that are familiar in various and have been commented upon in various studies.
Okay. Let's go to Prague for the next question.
Rina and John.
Irina Lagunina, Russian Service. I looked through this survey when you were talking, and the impression of Georgia that I have from it is that it's pretty stable, kind of adult country, with absolutely normal reaction of people to, garbage problems and demonstrations that disrupt their lives. I think the answer to the corruption question is just absolutely terrific, fantastic for especially for a Caucasus country, as we all know. And correct me if I'm wrong, that when I'm saying that Georgia is quite an adult country, there is a sense of stability that's coming from this survey. And do you think that any kind of protest can change this attitude of people or can seriously disrupt the present system that exists in Georgia?
Okay, I think, two parts to in the answer to that. I think, as you say, or you describe as an adult country, I think what we certainly see in that, and that's through multiple surveys, is that we're talking about people that are very measured in their approaches and often take fairly balanced judgments once you aggregate that. And I think that is also goes back to what I said before, that often there are these generalizations about these people are hot-headed, they're all very emotional, it's very difficult to get anything done. And I don't think that that's something we see from the data at all. In fact, we seem to be seeing fairly good judgment on a lot of issues once we aggregate the responses. So I agree with that, with the way you characterize that. Moving to the second part, what's the level of stability in that? Well, I think, as I showed towards the end, we do have a challenge specifically with regards to the very rapid economic changes to the deterioration of the economic situation. And it is an environment in which the stability on a certain level is held up by the government also not making major mistakes. The moment that the government found itself fundamentally out of step with the entire population, I think many people might reevaluate and think that the government is a threat to stability, and that it therefore needs to be changed, which is essentially the opposition's argument. So I think other things being equal, things will remain, or the general attitudes will likely stay pretty stable, but of course that's really based on that type of social contract that you have right now.
I've got a question here in Washington.
Hello, I'm Kelly Hash with American University. And a minute ago you said something about you gave the impression that people were expecting the government to take more care of the problems. I'm wondering if you picked up on this or if you asked a question about this in your survey about whether the people felt that they had the responsibility to do something either through protest or through more development of civil society, or if you noticed a lot of apathy.
Yes. Did everybody in Prague understand that? Just to make sure. Yes?
Yeah, all good.
This is a very good question, and it gets at the very heart of some of these things. Short term, the opposition has failed to convince the broader electorate to mobilize quite in the same way that the opposition wanted to. Medium term, there are challenges there are substantive challenges for the government. And the opposition protests were right to the extent that a lot of people are dissatisfied with many of the ways things have been going in the past. It's not that this is a blanket endorsement for the government. Moving towards the social challenges and to the question to with regards to citizen engagement, yes, this is a fundamental problem right now. So if you look at various social capital or civil society indicators, the extent to which people join up in civil association practically doesn't happen at all. The extent to which people read local newspapers, which, of course, many of them not provided, but if you read Robert Putnam as a critical component in actually engaging your community, doesn't really happen. Donating to charity outside churches doesn't happen at all. People rating themselves in terms of what's the level of control they have over their own lives, very widespread type of post-socialist apathy, really quite extreme, more something around 15%, saying, essentially, I have no control over my own life at all. By comparison, the U.S. will have on something like that 3% saying they have no control over their life at all. So I think Georgia, on a certain level, illustrates that it's not only government provision of a couple of things, and it's not just negative liberty, so to speak. It's not just the government getting out of a lot of things. There's also space that really needs to be filled. And I think this is a continuing riddle. We're trying to do more research on that. How do you get people to engage? How do you get them to cooperate consistently over time? Does that rely on legal structures as well? Does that rely on what are the cultural components? I think if we had an answer to that, and to that extent, Georgia is still a laboratory for a lot of broader reform. If we had an answer to that, we'd have an answer to many of the pressing public policy problems we have in many countries, because ultimately the failure of cooperation on a local level lies at the heart of a very, very broad range of public policy problems. And I think that's now, for the next 5-10 years, is going to be one of the challenges of democratization, getting people engaged locally.
Prague?
Here too. Yeah. Good morning. My name is Kenan Aliyev, and I'm the director of Azerbaijani service of RPRL. I'm disappointed as an Azeri to see that not so many Georgian women would like to marry Azeri man. that's one comment on this. But at the second comment, I'm looking at your numbers on Azerbaijan when you saying that 47% of Azerbaijanis think that their last elections were completely fair. This is, in my opinion, very disturbing numbers in terms of research. You know, I don't know who was conducting your research in Azerbaijan and who were the respondents, but this is, I would argue that many would agree in Azerbaijan that this is, I don't believe reflects the reality on the ground. You know, recently we had a poll in Baku asking people, what is your opinion about Aliyev's meeting with Harry Truman? And 6 people responded that, well, they approved the president's, way of negotiations. They were excellent meetings, and they were very pleased with the results. So, reminds me of that same poll when you cannot talk about fairness of elections in Azerbaijan in the way that it's really being, for example, conducted in the Western societies. So that's my comment on that. And I wonder who was your partner in Azerbaijan conducting this research.
And actually,
very interesting.
Along those same lines, in looking at some of the data, it did also come to me as a good question. Are Azeris truly as faithful and trusting in the process in their country and in their leaders as are indicated in the data? Or is there something else going on? Have they been so inured to what the expectations are of the government as it has stood since 1991 and before, that they know what their answers should be, and therefore is that skewing data?
Well, thank you for those questions. I think that they're absolutely relevant. And as I said, with that particular slide, that slide actually requires a lot of context in order to understand Azerbaijani data more closely. I think Václav Havel at some point said or described how some people in communist times would put up certain pictures and they were like sort of keeping the vampires from the door, party leader pictures, and that kept the vampires from the door, so to speak, and was a signal not so much of support, but certainly of a signal that people wanted to be left alone. In that particular context, you have to remember, first, the survey is countrywide. There are a lot of rural areas which have limited access to information and have also limited access to an understanding of the transformative processes that have actually been going on. Second, in Azerbaijan, an overwhelming amount of respondents tell us they're actually just not interested in politics. And it's not that they're only somewhat interested, they're absolutely not interested. So people have gone in a sort of internal immigration where they feel as long as some basic goods are being provided, the government's keeping its side of the deal. We conducted the survey ourselves with our own field workers. We checked it very rigorously. We've actually seen other people that have tried to sort of have done surveys that return similar results. And you really have to, I mean, the particular context within which people provide these responses really has to be taken into account. I mean, I could say a little more on that. I'm not sure it's entirely relevant to everybody here. But if if the basic point that you're making is do not take data like that as at face value and don't see it as just certifying that everything is wonderful, I absolutely agree. And more generally, I mean, I said this earlier in a conversation we had. You should look at any such presentation as a way of challenging the way you think and helping to understand things more deeply rather than as sort of a surface-level affirmation.
Okay. Questions here in Washington?
Hi, I'm Robert Ortung at the Jefferson Institute here in D.C. I was wondering about the Georgian opposition. You show that the issue peoples care about in the data are jobs and territorial integrity. And I was wondering if, obviously, the Saakashvili government's not delivering on those two things. So why hasn't the opposition been able to take advantage of that? Or, you know, is anybody focusing on those things? And how is the government staying in power if it's not delivering on what the people want?
Yeah, that's a very good question. I think that the key answer to to your question is really this, is that the type of discourse that the opposition went for following November 2007 was a legitimacy-based discourse. And it was a question of trying to illustrate that the government was actually illegitimate based on a range of things and based on a range of indictments that the opposition listed. That is a tempting way of going about it because it conformed to their own sense of injustice and to a sense of injustice that many people, that a sizable proportion of the population shared. But it is ultimately was a way in which the opposition fundamentally disabled itself and made it impossible for them for them to actually appeal to a broader constituency. Because that legitimacy discourse is like negative campaigning. You can sustain that for a short time, but by May 2008, that had already exhausted itself. And consequently, the real implosion of the opposition happened following the January elections, when it never actually managed to put a positive message forward, partially because they'd actually done with good intentions, had actually joined forces with a very wide array of political partners that didn't share a political platform at all, except for the platform of changing the government. So, which reinforced the idea of change at any cost, which only appeals to 20% of the Georgians, whereas, say, 50% aren't necessarily terribly happy with the way the government is doing things and might look for more, want the government to change the way it's doing things, but not at any cost. So, the key for the opposition, for any opposition party, will be three things. First, to actually build an apparatus that means you can run things, and that's right now is only headquarters. Few parties have anything approaching a proper headquarters. Secondly, get into the details a lot of political issues, including issues of electoral reform, where you have to make certain things stick, and that may be simple things as even the format of protocols or what's entered into electoral protocols or DEC or PEC composition. And thirdly, messaging. The problem is that some parties got into that. For example, the Republicans do have a lot of expertise on key issues with their leaders. But translating details into something that appeals and resonates and is understandable to a broad electorate is something that the parties all struggle with. So that's, I think, the type of homework or agenda that the opposition needs to address.
Prag? Mute, please.
I would like to add one thing. Quite a lot of opposition leaders were until recently the members of the government. Quite a lot of them. Some split with the government in recent weeks, some a bit earlier, but the number of those who had served in the government is quite big, and the number of those who really did have a chance to somehow solve the problems which are bothering the population right now. So this is one of the reasons why I think the public don't think that with the opposition winning whatever election or coming to power, that those problems would be solved. As for the opposition leaders who were never in the government, they have failed, I think, to provide their vision, which would be grounded their plan about how to solve the issue of territorial integrity or the issue of jobs. So these two reasons, I think, add up to what you have said, Hans.
Okay. Let's go to Prague for a question as well.
Yes. Hi. My name is Harry Tomrazian. I'm Armenian, and my question is about the culture. Our country's culture is increasingly threatened by Western cultural influences. There's, you know, very big difference in Armenia, in Azerbaijan, and in Georgia. Only 3% of Georgians strongly agreed to this, but 33% in Armenia, 39% in Azerbaijan. How do you explain these differences when these three countries are not that different culturally? Azeris have some religious differences, but they are very secular, very, you know, open societies mostly.
I'm afraid I'll have to pass on this particular one. I'd be happy to look in much more detail at the data. We were struck by some of the findings from Armenia, where also by November 2008, we were looking at a country that was really in a very, very dark mood. That certainly the impact of the economic crisis had already begun to hit there. Generally, we just looked at a country that was very gloomy about political prospects, and maybe that may have colored some of the broader views there as well. Also, in terms of what you said, I mean, I didn't show any of that data because it wasn't really relevant there, but when we asked about the sense of, we asked a range of social capital questions, you know, sense of missing friends, people having gone, having a sense of emptiness. From the November data, and we're really confident that we got that right because we've done that fieldwork in Armenia with the same team over and over again, and sort of related relatively well. We were looking at a country that was in I mean, you're almost tempted to say that was depressed at that moment when we took the snapshot. But I think, I mean, I'm happy to try and follow that up by email and look into more detail into that. And let me just add, though, that some of that's been borne out by some other surveys, like, say, Life in Transition Survey by the EBRD, and other surveys or surveys on subjective happiness, where Armenians often are seen as some of the least happy. I mean, the Georgians actually don't rate terribly well on that, as some of the least happy people where if you try and measure subjective happiness in the entire globe. So as I said, unfortunately, no in-depth answer to that at this point, but I'm happy to look into that in more detail.
Very good. If there are no other questions here in Washington or in Prague, like to...
We have one in Prague.
We do have one in Prague. Very good.
Hello, my name is Natalia Churikova. I'm from the Ukrainian service. I would like to come back briefly to the attitudes towards Russians. You only have indications about the attitudes towards Russians from April 2008. That means before the war. Right. Do you have anything, the recent data or the data after the war, directly after the war?
No, I'm afraid we don't. In this particular question, we haven't replicated since. As said, more generally, we've done other things that's on there. And as said, I mean, in terms of investment, trade, Russian companies owning, a lot of that looked really quite stable.
Okay, thanks.
Very good. Let me then give both of our speakers a chance to make any final comments. Just looking on the basis of this snapshot, looking forward, where do you see Georgia going and the situation developing over the next several months?
Should I start?
Yep,
please. We think, I mean, short term, we need to move beyond the particular impasse, and various groups need to work together with that. Medium term, we've got an economic challenge. Long term, both from the data that we see and from the way that what we hear from the respondents, we're actually optimistic that in spite of all the challenges that we see right now, it's an engaged culture. It has fairly mature views on a lot of issues. People want better politics. People want primarily better governance, which is important. So there are certainly short and medium-term risks. But beyond that, I think if people listen to what people say, and surveys are a good way of doing that, if the political elite listens to what the electorate and the Georgian people actually want, we're pretty optimistic that this could actually be seen as a success story in a couple of years.
David? Mute button. Larissa, could you hit the mute button over in Prague?
Okay. Is it okay now?
No. So it's not an easy question to answer. I partially tried to speak about what awaits us in the coming months. Well, summer is almost here, and it is a dead season in terms of political activities. And I think that unless the government finds a way to sit down and talk with opposition leaders in a way which would be acceptable for all sides, there will be another wave of mass demonstrations in autumn. On the other hand, the opposition, I think, will have to try to elect or select a single person, a single leader, which would be acceptable for the majority of those who are not satisfied with Saakashvili's government, because until now they really have failed to do so. There are quite a lot of important opposition figures, but none of them is considered as being one leader who would be followed by the majority of opposition supporters. So these are things which are going to happen, I think, in the coming weeks and months, and then a dialogue should take place, because until now the attempts of a dialogue were unsuccessful. The most recent example was a meeting between President Saakashvili and Levan Gachichilaza, one of the opposition leaders, on Tuesday, where actually this meeting didn't bring any results. So that's it.
Great. Thank you, David, for being with us today. Thank you, Hans, for giving us a lot to think about concerning the situation in Georgia. I'd like to thank our partners with the Eurasia Foundation for helping us put together this event. And, of course, thank all our audience here and in Prague and encourage you to come back next time for another one of our briefings. Thank you much.